But
I'm Steve Lazarus.
For the newcomers for the day, I'm Mark Wrighton, and together with Mark Fishman, I'm leading the Committee on the Management of University Intellectual Property. And today we have some really outstanding panel discussions that will inform our committee and help us in our work. The first session is going to be moderated and led by one of our committee members, Daria Sankey, who is the managing director of Zone Ventures. And this first session that will begin right now is Spawning New Companies Out of University Research, Startups and Spinoffs. Darius?
Good morning. So Steve Merrill gave me this great task of focusing on solutions in this panel. So our goal here really is to talk about how the discovery process of the university ultimately leads to startups. So as you know, yesterday we spent most of the time talking about intellectual property, but now in this panel we want to focus more on how we commercialize technology and it actually leads to the spawning of new businesses. And we'll have the similar format. We'll each have each panel introduce themselves and speak for about 3 minutes on the topic. We have Steve Lazarus with us from Arch Ventures, who's been in the venture business for many years, investing in startups out of universities. We have Tom Fogarty, who is a prolific inventor, who's invented a lot of devices in the medical device space and also invests in companies. Case Gorgon from Caltech, who's working in the TTO office there. Z. Holly from USC, who's Vice Provost of Innovation at USC and Director of the Stevens Institute and Mark Stevens Institute. And we have Don Siegel, who's studied the performance of the tech transfer process and will be talking to us about some metrics that we can use to measure the success of the process. So with that, I'd like to introduce Steve. You can go first.
As Darius said, I've been doing this for 22 years now, which I find a shocking number. Arch Venture Partners was formed at the University of Chicago in 1986. It spun out of the university after about 3 years because it unfortunately had a commercial success, which the university felt was jeopardizing its tax-exempt status. In the intervening time, we have raised 7 funds. We're currently investing the 7th. We have $1.5 billion under management. We virtually exclusively invest in companies that come from universities, come from the discovery process, also from national laboratories. We have done 142 companies in the intervening period, and I have some numbers about levels of success and failure, which if anybody is interested, I'd be glad to share. With respect to the subject at hand, my concern, as we had the preliminary discussions leading up to today, was that much of the material which I'd been reading, which had been distributed in anticipation of this conference, seemed to neglect a number of very important facts about the world we were operating in. First of all, with respect to university characteristics, we in Arch have found over time something that has never been contradicted, and that is that universities are entirely idiosyncratic and unique, and one is not like the other. They vary in so many ways, amounts of sponsored research, faculty status in terms of citations, National Academy memberships, prizes, regard of other high-value faculty, prior inventions, a range of different tech transfer offices, reporting level, background of staff, reach, whole university or partial. university culture? Is it feudal or cooperative? Full service, that's licensing and startups, and the material that we'd been sent seemed to have a bias toward defining university efforts as largely or almost predominantly licensing efforts. As a matter of fact, one paper felt that the name of the organization should not be Technology Transfer Office, but Technology Licensing Office, something I disagree with rather violently. And then with respect to the culture of the university, are there incentives? What is the policy for conflict of interest? Is there an inherent disdain for trade attitude on the campus, particularly on the part of the president and the provost, and a recognition that the research program is not the commons? Different measures of success, which I'm sure we will discuss as the panel goes on.
Tom?
Oh, okay. I'm an inventor who happens to be a physician and have practiced in both areas. It's going to be an interesting conversation, I think, and I hope. And I also hope there's disagreement. Whether or not we'll find that, I don't know. But just reading the preamble of this, hopefully we will. I think different perspectives are important to everybody if you listen to the perspective. My background does include exposure to venture. It does include relationships both with industry and with academia. I think if you have different perspectives that are based on these exposures, you come to different conclusions versus if you had a very focused effort in life. And it makes a big difference. Whether or not it's valuable or not, you can debate that, but I certainly think it is, and I think it's proven to be the case in my particular situation. Mr. Sansky mentioned a very significant thing about the differences in universities. That's absolutely true. Within one university, the attitudes can change very, very significantly over a very, very short period of time. And I've experienced that at Stanford in the medical center. The engineering schools continue with the concept that they are training people to go out and start companies. That is not the case in the medical school. It used to be that innovation and invention was rewarded in the medical school. And the change of deans really flip-flopped that 180 degrees, which has proved to be very, very disruptive with the exit of many of the faculty. I think that is not peculiar to Stanford. I think it's a characteristic of major universities who change deans. And if they change them every 4 years, they start to change the entire culture within that four-year period. So having been exposed to that, I perhaps have a very different perspective than many in this room.
Case.
At Caltech. That title is a bit of a misnomer, however, since we run a very small office, five FTEs, and we all basically do everything from cradle to grave and from licensing, but also managing the patent portfolio. I've been at Caltech for 2 years, and prior to that, I was in academia. My PhD is in molecular biology and virology, and I did my postdoc at Fort Detrick in biodefense vaccine development here in Frederick, Maryland. That characteristic of being a scientist, and also I'm a patent agent, is true of everyone in our office, and we can talk more about why that is later, but our office is very focused on the inventors themselves, and I'll talk about more about that as well. But the technology transfer philosophy at Caltech is centered around the inventors. We believe innovation starts and ends with the inventors. So our main focus is to foster that relationship with the researchers at Caltech, have a very positive relationship with those researchers so that they come to us and they disclose to us. We feel like that's the most important thing that we can do for them. And just to give a little background about Caltech and startups, we have actually done metrics in our office, and so since 1995 when the office began, over 90 startups have begun out of Caltech. 40% of those were VC-backed, others were friends and family, angels, small individual investors. Of those 90 startups, about 30% have failed. 30% have products in the marketplace. 25% have actually succeeded IPO or an acquisition, and the remaining 45% are ongoing. So we have a pretty good track record. Our school is very small. We have about 300 faculty, 900 undergraduates, 1,100 graduate students. Of the 300 faculty, only about 100 are active inventors that we create really close relationships with. The other 200 are what we call stargazers, which is they just do work that's too theoretical to really apply to have their work be patented. And so we really make an effort to identify the inventors that are prolific and interested in inventing, and we maintain really close relationships with those people. In our office, we really believe that tech transfer starts with the personal relationships.
Z?
Thanks. My name is Christina Hawley. A lot of people call me Z. Either one's fine. I'm the Vice Provost for Innovation at the University of Southern California, and what that means is I run an institute called the USC Stevens Institute for Innovation that I'll mention in a few minutes. But just by way of background, I'm an engineer and entrepreneur. My first startup was, you can call it a spin out of MIT in 1990, although it wasn't based on any technology that was licensed from the university. And I had the fortune many years later to then be invited back to be the founding director of the Deshpande Center for Technological Innovation at MIT, and that was in 2002. And I was there for 3.5 years. We gave out grants to faculty, $5 million worth of grants, actually, in the time that I was there, and developed a really strong, strong network of what we called catalysts that helped work with the faculty and the graduate students that worked with them. And primarily technologies, or engineering technologies, but open to the whole university. And in the time that I was there, we spun out 9 companies and facilitated that, and ended up, they raised $40 million in venture capital funding. I think since then, the spin-outs have raised over $100 million in venture capital. And we engaged over 200 faculty and students in that process, so that was really successful, and so I'd be happy to talk about that, that experience. And so now I run the USC Stevens Institute for Innovation, and what we do is, our mission is to help faculty and students make maximum impact with their ideas. So that could be in the form of startups, it could be in the form of nonprofits, it could be form of products, and most importantly, it's really about developing skills for lifelong innovation. So we work with we have 18 schools, we have 33,000 students. It's a very different environment from MIT. It's a fascinating change, and I'm loving it. It's a fantastic university with not just a top 10 engineering school and a medical school, but also 5 art schools. So it's a really broad mission, and that's something that's really important to me, and I'm happy to talk about that as well. And then one other thing that what I won't do, we had talked about, I could do a presentation on a VC study that we did, but we can maybe bring that up in the course of the conversation.
All right, Don.
My name is Don Siegel, and I'm the dean of the School of Business at the University at Albany. And I also wear 2 other hats which are relevant to the proceedings today. I serve as president of the Technology Transfer Society, which is a group of mostly academics who study the managerial and policy implications of technology commercialization. And the society does 2 things. We sponsor an annual research conference, and we also support the only academic journal that's devoted to the managerial and policy implications of tech transfer, called the Journal of Technology Transfer. So I'm going to try in 2.5 minutes to summarize some of the key findings from the academic literature on this activity which might lead to further discussion here today. I think that what we've learned from the academic literature is that really there are four key impediments to effective technology commercialization. The first is the existence of severe informational and cultural barriers between firms and universities, and this is especially apparent for small companies. So for entrepreneurial firms, this is a real problem. Second, there are insufficient rewards for faculty involvement in technology commercialization at many institutions, especially the entrepreneurial dimension. Third problem is TTO staffing and recruitment and retention and career paths. There's a lot of turnover in the technology transfer office, which is not conducive to developing relationships with companies. And some of the officers may not have sufficient entrepreneurial experience. The fourth impediment is on the educational side. A lot of those individuals involved in the research enterprise are not familiar with dealing with entrepreneurs and need education and experience in helping facilitate those kinds of relationships. We think more generally, and there's an article on this, if anybody's interested, I wrote with Phil Fan, who, like me, has been recruited into administration. He's now the vice dean at Johns Hopkins Business School. We've argued that universities need to think about this from a strategic perspective. They have to decide, first, which modes of technology commercialization are most important. Is it going to be sponsored research? Is it going to be licensing? Is it going to be startup activity? Or is it going to be property-based institutions like incubators and science parks, which have also been studied? And then on the implementation side, if we're treating this seriously as a strategic issue, we have to think about changing human resource management practices to facilitate these kinds of commercial relationships. We have to think about changing the reward structure for faculty involvement in technology commercialization, as other schools have done, like Texas A&M. And we have to think about implementation issues regarding the different modes of tech commercialization. So I'll finish with the modes that are most relevant for focusing on entrepreneurial activity and what we've learned from that, those studies. I think the key stylized fact that we've learned from studies of entrepreneurial activity at universities is that it's important to rely on surrogate entrepreneurs rather than academics to be entrepreneurial. We have to bring the surrogate entrepreneurs onto campus. That's critical. And the schools that are most successful at this are able to do this. Secondly, the university, there has to be a complementary educational system at the university. We have to have more courses on technology entrepreneurship. We have to have more research on technological entrepreneurship. And we have to demonstrate that we value this activity. I think some universities have established centers and institutes and senior administrative positions in entrepreneurship, a vice provost for entrepreneurship. RPI has one, Wake Forest has one, and it sounds like Christina is also serving in that type of capacity. So that demonstrates to the faculty and the stakeholders of the university that this is important. So those are some of the stylized facts I think we know from the academic literature.
All right. So as you can see, we have a great cross-section of experiences here. I'd like to sort of guide the conversation where we'll start sort of from the top down in looking at the VC perspective and, you know, what do VCs expect from the process? And I know, Steve, you will have some comments on this as well. But Christina, could you comment? Christina did a study of, 94 VCs, and if you could just comment on what the results of that were.
And I think, you know, for context and by way of leading into that, I want to acknowledge the fact that not all startups out of universities are venture funded, just like Case had mentioned, and only 40% of theirs have been, and not all should be. But at the same time, we do believe that venture financing is a very important source of funding for high-growth startups. And, I had a lot of experience at MIT with helping startups raise financing. It was incredibly successful. But then coming to USC, it's a very different situation. And I felt like I really wanted to, I didn't want to just go with my gut and one experience and wanted to get a little bit more of a authoritative view or empirical view of this, this process. So what we did was we interviewed 94 venture capitalists. There were partner or managing director level folks in various technology areas, everything from life sciences to clean tech, IT, et cetera. But the most important thing was that they were they had tried to or actually did license technologies and invest in companies out of universities. And we looked at, we interviewed VCs from across the country. So three things that I wanted to share with you, the motivations of the venture capitalists, challenges that they faced, and they've faced a lot of challenges with universities, and then kind of how, what are the different ways that universities can add value to the process and facilitate that process. So motivations, it's really about, and what they told us and reinforced was that it's about deal flow. They want to see good deals so that they can invest in. It's really their role to figure out which ones they want to invest in. But they made it very clear that not every technology that comes out of a university is appropriate for a venture-backed startup. So I'm sure that Steve can talk about that. You know, what makes a good startup. But a lot of the things that we heard was, you know, we have limited partners that expect to have a return, and we have a 10-year fund, and so in general these things have to end up having a big exit on the order of, you know, a couple $100 million within 5 to 7 years. The reality right now is a separate study, not ours, but the average has grown to about 8.6 years, so that things are getting quite challenging in that area, but that's what they're looking for. And it needs to be more than a feature or just a product. It needs to be some sort of a base technology, maybe platform that could then grow into a whole line of products. And also, inventor is definitely part of the deal, but not as CEO, usually. So those are the things that they expect and that what they're looking for. And Steve can probably comment on that in a moment. The challenges that they faced in working with universities. Well, first of all, they said VCs are not ATMs. And unfortunately, a lot of inventors are treating them like they're just a source of financing. But they really see themselves as a partner in the process, people with significant experience that they can bring to the table. And it's done, and they're not there for philanthropy purposes. They don't want to have to wade through hundreds of technology abstracts. They want to only see the ones that just make sense as a startup. It's not like they expect the tech transfer office to evaluate whether it will make a good startup, but it needs to, you know, they don't want to see things that are going to be licensing deals. In general, the timing, and that's what they're getting from universities, unfortunately. They're not getting a lot of help in that area. They're just getting all these abstracts. The timing tends to be off, too. Usually they say they have to add 2 to 3 years to the projections of time to market. That's how far off things are. And so they acknowledge that that's fine. I mean, it's a long-term deal. Universities are very early stage, but that's one of the challenges that they face is that expectation. They see tech transfer offices as often people with just a contracts and legalistic view as opposed to a business development view and a view of how this can turn into a startup as a win-win. And so it's really important and they're having the challenges that working with those universities that look at it from more of that legalistic contracts perspective. And the final challenge that's very common is the unrealistic expectations of faculty. Faculty expecting that they're going to be CEOs, their role in the company, and also the value of the idea. I mean, they think that the idea is 90% of it, when in fact it's, you know, this much of the startup, and you're just getting started. So those are some of the challenges. So finally, how do universities, in particular tech transfer offices, add value to the process? So in general, there are differences between universities with culture, and Stephen mentioned that too, and also Tom did too, about, you know, the attitudes towards commercialization, about entrepreneurship, and there's a whole ecosystem. Certain universities have this ecosystem around them, and it doesn't just have to do with, do you have you know, a venture fund or do you have VCs in the area, but it also has to do with attitudes of the faculty, and it has to do with the people that are engaged with the university, has to do with the student engagement, all of that. Another way of adding value, so there's four ways that I just want to touch on. The second one is providing advice and coaching and setting the expectations of the faculty so they know what to expect and they know that about the values, about what their role is going to be in this startup, and also so that, as one VC said, that they can mature as business people. A lot of faculty don't have any clue how to get started, and they also have very, it's important to give that advice. Third thing was, the VCs aren't quite sure why the TTOs have to be the intermediary in the process. A lot of them, don't quite see where the value add is. So they'd really like to at least, to start with, just have transparent deal making and make it really smooth. And fourth, there are ways of adding that value. VCs love to have technologies that have been supported in the university setting. They didn't have to pay for all that development. There's huge value there. What's challenging is there's so much of it. How do you negotiate? I mean, literally, we do $500 million in research every year. How do you negotiate that whole web of faculty, students, et cetera? So there's a huge value that tech transfer offices or whoever, in our case, it's broader than tech transfer, where our institute can help point people in the right direction, make introductions, and the best universities actually send emissaries out into the venture community and pitch and kind of prep and make introductions. And VCs don't always need to see a deal. They're also really happy to just meet really interesting inventors. So just making the introduction and letting the magic happen is a huge value that isn't happening in a lot of universities. So basically, there is an opportunity for tech transfer offices to make a difference and for universities to make a difference. And that's the feedback that we had received from the venture capitalists.
Thank you. Steve, we certainly wanted to hear from you on this point, but in specific, just to give the audience a little bit of context, I believe you've been doing this now for 20 years, over 10 funds, is that right? Or 7 funds. So keep in mind, 140 deals over 7 funds when you're doing early stage. Can you comment on what you've learned in that process, but also comment on sort of the size of the fund and the size of deals that you've done and how long it really does take to get, once you initiate the process, what you've gone through and the sort of steps that it takes a VC to actually get a company out of a university.
Perhaps it'd be useful if I took just about a minute and tell you how Arch Venture Partners got started. Arch, by the way, is an acronym for the Argonne National Laboratories and the University of Chicago. Chicago, since World War II, has been the manager of the Argonne National Laboratories. During the late 70s and early 80s, an investigator at the University of Chicago named Eugene Goldwasser synthesized erythropoietin from urine. That was quite a dramatic invention. Erythropoietin, the red blood cell stimulating factor, had been a kind of holy grail that people had searched for quite some time. Eugene's department didn't protect the invention. The university had no technology transfer office. They used one of these subscription contracts where somebody came in once a quarter and examined the discoveries of the moment. In any event, the discovery was not patented, not protected. Eventually, a company called Amgen picked it up, pursued it. And by the way, to move from the point that Gene Goldwasser was at to the point of a product called erythropoietin or EPO was an immensely difficult effort. What Amgen put into that was extraordinary. But in any event, the University of Chicago saw practically nothing. Gene Goldwasser got a chair named after him, and that was about it. In contrast to either Kohn-Boyer at Stanford and UCSF or Richard Axel's Chinese hamster ovary discovery at Columbia, university trustees and the faculty in particular were very discountenanced by that fact. The trustees decided they needed some form of technology transfer organization. what they set up had no precedent, and this was not my idea. It was before I arrived. They set up an organization which would be domiciled in the business school. The dean of the business school was a very active proponent of this idea, that the organization would have cash incentives to its management and specific and substantive cash incentives to the investigators, and that, and this probably is the most important point of all, the organization would be more incentive to do startups than to do licensing. Theory being, and which I think has worked out empirically, that the university could stand to gain more by having equity in a startup as opposed to a stream of royalties. I was then retiring from a company called Baxter Laboratories. I came down to be the head of this new organization, which consisted of one employee, me, and associate dean of the business school, which was also quite important, giving me some kind of platform at the University of Chicago. University of Chicago has a reputation for being a temple of theoretical science. Actually, it's a place that is very congenial to experimentation. It is said that you can do anything at the University of Chicago you would like to, provided you don't do it in the street and frighten the horses. I'll spare you all the trials and tribulations of getting this organization started. Key, however, was the location in the business school and the hunger on the part of the business school student body to participate in this kind of activity. And I was overwhelmed by volunteers almost that first day. Having had no prior experience in managing a horde of students who, you know, herding cats, we still managed to get an organization put together. And it was these students working sometimes 40 hours a week over and above their academic loads who did the first marketing probes. And as stated in some of the material you've received, one of the great deficits of a university attempting this kind of activity is an absolute zero understanding of what marketing is all about, the difference between technology push and market pull. As a matter of fact, at one point we made T-shirts up for our 67th Street Irregulars, which is what we call the students, which simply said, who shall buy? It was the key question that we were always posing. We were successful because we managed to raise a venture fund. Very unusual endpoint for a university-based system. I had flown to the West Coast, flown to the East Coast, tried to get people to come in and look at our technology. Partner in Kleiner Perkins told me he had a gyroscope in his head that turned him around at the Nevada border. It was very difficult to get the coastal VCs to fly to that dark place called the Heartland. So we set out to raise a venture fund. I'll also spare you that story, which took about a year. But we raised $9 million. With that $9 million, we started 12 companies. Ultimately, four were abject failures. My percentages are very similar to Z's. Four were abject failures, four were reasonably successful IPOs, and four were very successful M&A transactions. And suddenly, we had produced for the university a result that was about an annual internal return of about 26%. At that point, the university trustees became less enthusiastic, as did the administration, worrying about their tax status. And so they spun us out, and that was the beginning of our venture fund. I and three of my student associates, who became my partners and are still my partners to this day, spun out, and the rest is history, at least according to us. I've spoken, I think, too long on that point, so I'll stop.
No. I mean, that was good. One thing I wanted you to talk initially about is when you're working with a university, what are the processes that you actually go through from, you know, the discovery phase through actually funding a startup? And what do you feel like universities should be doing in this process to help facilitate that?
Well, over time, we've internalized some crude tests of what might be likely to be a licensed invention and what is the core of a startup. We look for discontinuity. We look for game changers. We look for what's called by the business schools disruptive technology that really represent a substantial change from what exists or what has gone before. Particularly in the biological sciences, we look for platform technology. That is a technology that can yield more than one embodiment of an invention. In looking at what Tom has done over the years, his great skill is in not a single invention, but a whole series of inventions built from a certain kind of science and a certain set of ideas. So that's the kind of effort that we look for in starting up. We look for protection, for patent estate. What we're doing here is an allocation of capital decision. We are using other people's money, and you simply cannot put other people's money, where you're acting as a fiduciary, into something that is, you know, has a good chance of failing. This is a high odds game. So we look to see that the idea, at least at the lab notebook stage, is protected or is being protected. And over time, we have learned how to do this in a very sophisticated fashion. We look for competition. Who else is out there doing the same kind of thing? And if possible, we try to roll that competition up into the startup that we're embarking on. When we set out to do a company in pain management, a new form of opiates that didn't have the deleterious side effects, we found one receptor at the University of Chicago, one receptor at the University of Indiana, two more receptors at two other institutions, and we put all that into a single company. We're looking for productivity improvement, but we won't go into 10% or 20% or 30%. We won't even begin unless there's an opportunity for 100% or more productivity improvement. And finally, that key question, who will buy? We're not going to start a startup unless we have some idea of who the ultimate customer is. It can be as crude as, if this really does create a red blood cell factor, then we have no concern about who will buy. Anybody who's treating anemia will buy. But sometimes it's not as clear as that.
So, Tom, you obviously have been on both sides of the equation. So you've been both an investor as well as on the inventor side. Can you comment on your role as an inventor and issues that you've faced in developing technology under a university umbrella?
Well, relative to, we call it OTL, Office of Technology and Licensing, I've really had relationships that are pretty positive, and the majority of those have been positive. But occasionally, particularly if you have a new OTL, OTL then stands for out to lunch. But you have to deal with it. And it may take much longer to do it, but ultimately you get it done. When you deal with the OTL, essentially you're negotiating. So negotiation brings up perspectives and feelings that sometimes are not positive, and you should understand that. You should also understand that the OTL has a very, very significant responsibility to create value, and that's why they're negotiating. So, and over the years, I've seen really significant improvement in OTLs. They now understand business much better than they used to. So the OTLs do really serve a very, very valuable asset if you use them correctly and understand their responsibilities. So I'm not really had a problem with OTL offices. Sometimes I have had trouble with the environment in which they exist. And that can be a real, real bad problem, both for OTL and the inventor. If you have someone that views industry as the evil empire, you're not going to get very far. If that's the overriding culture of that medical school, if you have someone who views industry as a collaborative and cooperative group that's going to help benefit patient care, it's a very, very different story. And I do think that if we're going to deal with universities, you should identify one that understands that the final step of innovation is commercialization. The final step of innovation is commercialization. And it's a very important step. You can invent the best thing in the world, but if you don't get it commercialized, it's going to value to no one. It'll benefit no one. And what we're here for is to benefit patients. And it's important that you understand that. Now, we're talking about venture people and their responsibilities. Obviously, they have limited partners, and they invest money with the idea that they're going to get a return. So we do have a fiduciary responsibility as venture people to our limited partners. As a physician, you have a fiduciary responsibility to patients. Those two can coexist. And if you look at it from that way, benefit patients, you'll make money. And that has been my perspective, and it's been my experience. So, but once again, you're serving two masters. What does that mean? It means you have a conflict of interest. How you handle that conflict is critically important. Understanding value allocation within that framework is critically important. So does that answer your question, or I'm just lecturing about nothing?
No, no, no. I'd like Don to comment on this, because clearly, you know, when you make this decision of whether you're going to go become a company or not, and how you make that decision and deal with this conflict is kind of a key point here.
Yeah, I just want to say some more words in favor of what I consider to be a favorable trend at the TLOs or OTTs, or I never heard out to lunch. I like that one. I never heard that one before. But and at the TTOs, which is that because universities are now finally really confronting this issue from a strategic standpoint, I think we've observed over time that they have realized that the entrepreneurial dimension is the way to go for most universities, that they're not going to get the blockbuster licensing deals, and that this is the dimension to focus on, because there are lots of positive externalities, I think, associated with these startups, and a lot of benefits that accrue to other units on campus and to other stakeholders. So, and we've observed that, I think. And when I go to the autumn meetings every year, I see more and more sessions on how to deal with venture capitalists, how to deal with entrepreneurs. So the TLOs have definitely evolved over time to becoming more receptive to working with entrepreneurs. But this is all, you know, I think part of a strategy, a conscious strategy that's taking place, shift in strategy at the university level, to become more receptive to working with angel networks, establishing alumni commercialization funds. I think the universities have come to recognize that there are some tremendous opportunities here, also in terms of development as well.
So, Case, you guys sound like you have an incredible track record. I mean, I actually been in this business a long time, and I don't think I've heard of any VC fund getting 40% sort of success rate. Can you comment on how you guys prepare inventors and entrepreneurs to develop startups, and why you think that Caltech has been so successful at this process?
Well, as I said when I started out, one of our main focuses is on the inventor and the importance of the inventor in this whole process. you know, not all, we don't only do startups, obviously, we do all licensing in our office. I think it kind of falls out fairly clearly early on whether something is suitable for a startup or just a licensing deal. So just focusing on the ones that have the inventor interest in actually going forward and doing a startup, there's a few things we do, first of all, to manage our interactions with the VCs. So our office does not try to be heavy-handed in how the VCs interact with our researchers and our PIs. We try to establish long-term relationships with a lot of VCs, angels, that we have come into campus. We have roundtable discussions with them, as Z did, not as formally as USC Stevens did, but just ongoing feedback from them to see what they need from us and when they need us to get out of the way. We are fine with that, and we also introduce those VCs, again, more on a one-on-one networking level with our more entrepreneurial faculty, even if they don't have a particular idea at the time or the particular idea that's being discussed turns out it's not really a good candidate for a startup. It's all about the ongoing relationship so that those VCs feel comfortable just calling up these more entrepreneurial faculty, and they keep a long-term ongoing relationship to say what's new, what's coming out of your lab. That goes on all the time, and we encourage that. We let them talk to each other. We don't need to be involved in those kind of conversations because we feel that really creates a network that is there. Then when a good idea does come, there's a network there of people that they can go talk to. We do also, on a slightly more formal basis, we do 3 to 4 times a year. We'll bring in VCs, a very small forum, and we'll do what we call tech reviews, where we showcase 3 to 4 technologies that are newer. We prepare our investigators ahead of time. Our office does, the tech transfer office, we have them run through their technologies, and we give them feedback based on our own training of what the VCs want. Obviously, the inventors tend to be a little more scientific, and so we need to tell them to tone it down on the scientific details and what they need to put in from the business standpoint. Again, a lot of this is based on what we hear from our VCs. We are the tech transfer office has an ongoing relationship with these people as well, so we love to hear feedback from them to see how we can, what the information is that they need from us and how can we get that to them. A lot of it becomes then inventor education to tell them, you know, not all your technology is going to be the big hit. No one wants to hear that they have an ugly baby, but occasionally you have to say this just isn't going to, you know, it just doesn't serve as a good basis for a startup. Or a common framework is that the PI himself or herself isn't going to leave to do the startup, but a postdoc is, right? It's a project that's ongoing, and maybe these projects need to have a champion. They need to have the passion and commitment of the inventor to get behind them. Now, the inventors don't always stay involved. Not 100% of startups are that way. Sometimes other people or peers or a collaborator will be the scientific person heading up the drive of the startup. But frequently it's a postdoc or grad student whose project it was. Occasionally we get overeager ones who, you know, the first slide going up says, I'm the CEO of this company, and we've got to tell them to take that down, and they want to put it up. And so there's a lot of inventor education of saying, you know, you have to understand your role is maybe not what you imagine it is, so that either comes from our office or a combination of from our office or from these VCs and our tech reviews are not even necessarily to raise money at that time for this particular idea or startup, but also just to get feedback and create these long-term relationships with our VCs or angels, who then it just turns into a roundtable discussion about that idea to get feedback from the VCs on what they think this person could improve on, what information they might need to know more about. The other thing is we have more recently, within the past couple of years, developed a more formal network with the alumni, entrepreneurial alumni. Again, not for fundraising per se, but to bring them in and give reviews on these technology reviews, to give account mentoring to the more entrepreneurial faculty, postdocs, grad students who are interested in that. And we can set up those relationships either through the tech reviews or just on a one-on-one. You get a postdoc or someone new just walks in the office and says, you know, can I get help with X, Y, or Z? And we can either help ourselves or set up these relationships. Again, it all comes back to our attitude in the tech transfer office is that we are there to serve the inventors. Everything starts and ends with getting the inventors on board, having a very positive relationship with them, to get them also to not only come to us for help when they want to, they have sort of entrepreneurial interest, they want to get a company started, but also just to get the disclosures coming in the first place. We simply try to say yes as much as we can to create a positive environment for our inventors to come to us and talk to us and disclose. As I said, we have 300 faculty, only about 100 we consider active inventors. We get about 200 disclosures a year, so that's actually very high. And the reason is we try to always say yes to them, first of all. Yes in the patenting, right? So the first interaction we have with them would be a disclosure. They say, we have an idea. We try to never say no. Now, the way we do that is we almost always file provisionals. One way we do that and manage costs is that, as I had said earlier, everyone in our office not only has a scientific background, so the researchers and the PIs feel comfortable coming to us. They feel like we can understand them, even if it's not exactly our field of training. We can still understand them and have a dialogue about it, so they feel comfortable coming and talking to us about their science. Second of all, that we will be open to it and we'll say yes to them. So we file provisionals on every campus disclosure. We also manage all the JPL technology. That's not as relevant here, but on every campus disclosure, we file provisionals. We can do that because we're all patent agents in the office, so we do that in-house. So it's a relatively inexpensive way for us to say yes at the get-go and develop a positive relationship with them. Now, that doesn't mean that we have an unlimited amount of money to spend on patenting and we get a patent on everything that comes in the door. Of course not. That doesn't make sense. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. You don't need, maybe we're, you know, people are trying to patent too much. Our purpose at that stage of the game is to establish a positive relationship with the faculty, as I said, so that they like to come to us. We then involve them in the process all along the way to keep that relationship going. And after a year of the provision, well, about 9 months into our year of filing the provisional, we involve the inventor again in saying, how is the project going? Where do you think it's going? Is there a market potential? Let's talk about if you were to make a product, what would the customer be? We really involve them in that process, and if it's not going well, we try to get them to say no, that we understand. So there's a lot of inventor education from the patenting standpoint of saying, we say, we've got a limited budget. Do you really think this is worthwhile? What are your plans to do with it? If it were to be licensed, who would it go to? A large company? Do you have a postdoc that wants to do a startup? We have this very long conversation with them about where they think it should go so that they feel empowered in the decision whether or not to go forward. Most of the time, they are very receptive to that. Most of the time, they give us good feedback. And again, because there's a lot of trust with our office, they are willing to say, yeah, you know, this, I agree, maybe this isn't the best thing to go forward with. And so that maintains a positive relationship. Of course, occasionally you'll get the ones where you actually disagree, where the tech transfer office thinks, well, I really don't see the potential. But then it becomes a political issue, right? You've got a big professor who says, I must have it, I must have it. That actually happens less than you think. It is not a major problem, although it happens. And then it becomes a judgment call. Really, do you think the patent is worth it versus the squawking that will happen if you don't go forward with the filing? But it's not a major issue because we have such an ongoing dialogue with these people and have educated to them as to why we want a patent and where our finite patent resources should go. So from the patenting standpoint, they feel very comfortable coming to us. Again, as patent agents, we are very involved in all the prosecution decisions. So every step, not only the conversion from provisional to non-provisional, but prosecution points thereafter, we get feedback from them and say, you know, we're having problems with this prosecution. Is it really worth going forward? Has there been licensee interest at this point? So you kind of have multiple checkpoints along the way. So we obviously don't continue prosecution to the bitter end on everything, but it creates a positive environment for these, for the researchers to come to us and work with us. On the startup side, the entrepreneurial environment in general that needs to exist in order to have a good startup community can be seen as the technical expertise that, say, postdocs, grad students that need to be able to work on the technology, good management experience. A pool of good management experience in the area, both a local, maybe the city that you're in, so for Caltech it would be the city of Pasadena or the greater LA area that is amenable to startups and entrepreneurial activities, space, available space, not necessarily incubators per se, but lab space in general that would be available in the area for our startups. the flow of technology that would come from the university, obviously, and the available VC funding. So for our instance in particular at Caltech, we've got four of the six, so we do struggle with both space and a pool of management that is locally in the area. And again, this would apply more to having startups that stay if you're trying to get a startup community built around your particular institution. But in general, the area around Caltech is fairly conducive to that, so that's another reason that we do pretty well. The other thing that we do is we give options to our faculty inventors so instead of doing a full-out license, we actually do an option to them, or we encourage them to incorporate. At that stage, they would own 100% of their company, and that allows, usually it's for about a year, that allows them to go out and meet with venture capitalists one-on-one to get not only feedback from them, but also so the VCs can see that, yeah, you've got this technology tied up. There's now a year that we can look at what the market could be, what the commercialization potential would be. Is this really going to be a good fit? And that allows the Tech Transfer Office to empower the faculty to be able to have those relationships themselves, and we don't need to be involved all the time to slow the process down. Our options are very flexible. We defer all patent costs. We partner with the entrepreneurial faculty for success. We're very flexible in all the terms. We take equity. We defer patent costs and any upfront fees. Well, obviously there has to be some consideration, but it's very low, less than $1,000 that the faculty can do on their own. We'll trade patent costs. We continue to be flexible throughout the process. We trade patent costs for equity if that looks like what the company needs. We don't want to put anybody out of business because that only hurts us. So we really try to partner with the company for success early on and defer as many costs for them as we possibly can. We also grant improvement rights. We see that seems to be a sticking point with a lot of licenses, but we routinely grant improvement rights, see that as a valuable term in the agreement. We also ask that they raise $500,000 to exercise the option. So when Caltech counts a startup, so when I'm talking about a startup, this is going to be something that in which Caltech has equity, but they have also raised at least $500,000 in funding in order to exercise that option and turn it into a license.
How much equity Caltech takes in and whether that equity ever becomes valuable in the long run?
So in the past 6 years, there has been $22 million in equity returns. The equity varies. Every term in our options and our licenses, actually, is very flexible. But the baseline that we try to go from is 5% equity, 2% royalty. But it's a zero-sum game. There are times when we get startups that they don't want that. They don't want to give that much equity. They would actually prefer to take a higher royalty. So that's fine with us. We completely actually leave that up to them. It's just a conversation between us and them. But frequently, it's a win-win for the startup, too, because they want to defer as many costs as they can. They prefer to give equity up front. So it's about 5%.
So, Steve, can you comment a little bit about that negotiation process? I mean, do you find that difficult, or is it something that you guys set the terms and the university and you force the universities to go along with it?
That's one thing we just don't do, because it's a fruitless kind of endeavor. If you try to impose a template on every deal in every university, you're just going to spend a lot of time spinning your wheels. Each of these is unique. The technology or the science is unique. The character of the investigator or the inventor is unique, and I could go on and on. Every parameter is unique. So every deal starts from square one. We do try to understand as we go into it how much capital it is going to take to get this startup to the marketplace, to what Tom calls commercialization. In our formula, it's to point of liquidity, either IPO, that's those days when IPOs existed, or M&A transactions. We do find in general that the universities and the technology transfer offices are beginning to understand about what share of the equity they will seek. A lot depends on how many rounds of capital is going to go into this company, because every new round after the university's transaction is going to dilute the ownership at the university that all of us have. So I think we as venture people start or try to start with something in excess of 50% because we want control of the deal. We feel responsible to progress it forward, and we need that much of the board of directors in order to exercise our judgments. But we seek, at the end of the day, something between 15 and 20% at the point of exit. Once again, it depends on whether there are further rounds of capital put in. The university, the sophisticated universities, want to make sure that the inventor is properly incented, that the inventor's department, extremely important, that the department support the activity, is properly incented. Some universities want to take portion of it at the top, some don't. It's hard to give you a fixed number. It's somewhere in the range of 20-25%.
So one aspect you guys haven't touched on is normally you have an inventor who has a technology and it's not quite ready for the market. They haven't written a business plan yet. Tom or Case, can you comment on how that's managed? Like how are the feasibility studies funded? How do you figure out what the right business strategy is? What processes are sort of set up in universities to help complete and package a technology so that it's ready for commercialization?
The way I look at it is that we'll look at a concept or an idea where there's no business plan, sometimes. And we'll look at something that has completed business plan. I like to be part of the process and invest in that process myself or the venture fund. So it doesn't bother us that much that we're going to have to do some preamble work. And certainly, usually the clinical studies have to be done at the time you're making an investment in a very early stage company. So it's really different depending on where you are. Later stage companies handle things very, very differently. And that's a way to do it. It's a way that many prefer to do it. It works. But it's just a matter of what you want to do as a venture person. And so it's like Steve was saying, it's different. It's never the same. There's no standard contract that you can make with OTL. Every situation is different. Different people bring different values, and you have to reward those based on what you think their value is. Now, that's where an argument starts, but you have to understand the mentality of some of these people. A physician thinks because he came up with an idea that may not be patentable, should get the majority of the return. Well, that's not the way it works. What I do when that comes up, I say, well, try elsewhere. We just don't think you bring that value. And you may get it, and good luck. If they want to be president or chairman or King Kong of a startup, I do the same thing. I say, you know, I don't think you'll get this done, but, you know, go talk to whoever you want. I'll give you some names. The most dangerous startup are those usually run by a physician that spent his life in academia.
Absolutely.
They do bring value, but usually it's a CTO, chief technical officer. And sometimes they can be part-time, and sometimes they choose to be full-time. But they have to understand their position in the framework of a startup. And if they don't, or you find out they don't, then you have to change, because it'll be an ongoing problem that disrupts the team. And as soon as you recognize that, you got to pull the gun, or the trigger, I guess they say. Now, I got to tell you, Darius, I'm very disappointed in you.
Okay.
Everybody on this panel agrees with one another.
Well, it's
I want you to...
Can I ask a question that might spark some division among you?
Good.
We've heard from some who suggest that in order to be more efficient, to gain more from the intellectual property that's created at universities, that instead of having universities as owners of the IP, that the inventors should have ownership of the IP.
Yeah, I would love to. I read the papers, the 5-foot shelf of papers that we were given to prepare for this meeting, and several of them suggest that the inventor take title to the invention and be responsible for the commercialization of that invention, which is something like taking a locomotive engineer and trying to get him to be a song and dance man. He will fail and the trains won't run. It has got to be the singular worst idea I have ever heard. Think about the fairness of that kind of a decision. Here's something that started with the taxpayers paying tax into a government which bundled some of those tax dollars into a grant which goes to a university, which then is put in the hands of an individual who performs a work for hire, which the title of the result of that work goes to the university, and whose instincts and training and inclination are all to be a discoverer, an investigator, a scientist, and say, Go raise some money from the syndicate. Go write the business plan. Go rent some space. And do all those things that are much more properly done by what I call an intermediary organization, the one that has a foot in the university and a foot in the commercial entity.
So can I ask you to tweak apart three aspects of that? It seems to me you addressed one is the capabilities of particular individuals and organizations.
Okay, that's where we begin. Yeah.
Who's skilled at doing what? Another aspect of it is financial incentives. Okay, that is how do you arrange ownership in order to create the right set of incentives to cause things to happen. And the third is some sense of economic fairness. That's sort of the work for hire. Seems like those are three separate arguments that one could apply in this case. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, just how truly separate they are, I think there's an overlap among them.
But I could imagine believing in the incentive aspect of inventor ownership while also believing that faculty inventors are uniquely incapable of bringing things to market.
I suppose it goes to the suggestion that this function be performed as a kind of commons or open source, which phrases which are used interchangeably and ought not to be. An incentive is critical. It's the sine qua non of this process. People simply do not work as hard as this requires without some form of incentive, and therefore an ownership position or something that looks like an ownership position and is sufficing doesn't have to be all, but it has to be recognizable as a reasonable reason to go forward and do it over and over and over again.
Done.
Incentives are critical.
Yeah, of course incentives matter. We've had several academic studies which show that when the royalty distribution formulas are more favorable for the faculty, there's more technology commercialization at the university, but having the inventor have the sole responsibility and ownership of the intellectual property is a model that currently exists in several European countries, and they're moving away from it. I mean, it's not working there. There's not. Well, I don't think it's working. That's my understanding of the literature, and that's why they're moving towards our model, where the universities manage the intellectual property, and that's because it's more efficient. I mean, it's as the policymakers have defined that.
This is great. We got four hands raised.
All right. Kathy,
really stimulating.
I just wanted to point out to everyone that there's two incentives in a startup situation. The inventor often gets equity in the company directly with the company, and then there's the royalty incentive through the university. So there's two very different incentives. And at Stanford, we think that they generally get more when they're the consultant with the company. They're not getting
coming up here.
I think that great entrepreneurs happen in all sorts of places. I don't think Irwin Jacobs of Linkabit and Qualcomm is a bad entrepreneur. He's a professor. I don't think Qualcomm was a relatively big success. His biggest success is probably any.
That's one.
Broadcom, the professors who started Broadcom, that was a good success.
There are always exceptions, but if you look at the majority,
correct.
It doesn't work.
There are exceptions everywhere. Inventors come out of firms and start great firms. Many fail. So the question about inventor ownership is particularly in cases where you have OTLs that are very difficult to deal with. Inventor ownership is a way to move around that. My guess is that many inventors will go to the good OTLs anyway because they know that they're delivering value. So the question is, where are you putting the ownership such that you get incentives to the inventor to do the right thing? I don't think inventors are all so stupid that they couldn't figure out eventually that they need to go to a good OTL. Naomi Lamoureux has written this wonderful paper about the 1890s, 1910s, where inventors went to licensing kind of agents to help commercialize their inventions. They knew. I mean, this is the period of the mechanical.
But there you don't have a government subsidy program. You don't have a university as an intermediary. You don't have a work for hire going on. Hell, in the 18th century, you had the Lunar Society, which was made up of inventors who, as Tom says, defined the whole process as ending with commercialization, and they were going to do it all.
So there you're talking about what should the government, which funded the money, get in return? So one could easily figure out things like a 5% automatic ownership to the university or the government or whoever you want to give it to. Actually, Cambridge, where they changed the rules, it used to be inventor ownership completely. And Cambridge was the most innovative, most entrepreneurial place outside of the United States, where there was the most university entrepreneurship. There's no debate about that. That's not to be debated. And that's provable. So now they've changed the rules, and what did they put as an incentive in place? They said if the inventor still wants to own it, they must give 15% to the university, 7.5% to the department, 7.5% to the university. So there's an inventor ownership scheme. We'll see how it works.
So I think I agree with a lot of what's being said, even though everybody's disagreeing. And I think that it is very important for OTLs to add value. I think that regardless of what the model is, I think that OTLs need to show that value. And I think that there are cases where OTLs are not adding value. They're slowing down the process. So I might suggest that we need to think of what are the solutions. How can the OTLs be adding more value as opposed to completely, you know, rewriting everything? I'm open to all ideas. I do think that I think it was Dana who brought up the point yesterday about the fact that we do have legal obligations, contractual obligations. There are conflict of interest issues. There are concerns that if things go out the back door, and I've seen this happen, when things go out the back door, there are it tends to lead to legal liabilities. It tends to lead to conflicts of interest. It leads to students being taken advantage of. And so I think that the OTL can play a very important role in serving as a central point of understanding what kind of IP is happening in the university. Now, we're being very flexible, and we're moving to a model where if we can't handle it, if it's not something that's that we can add value to, then we do want to say, okay, faculty member, feel free. Do what you want with it. We'll get a small amount of it in terms of fairness, but we don't want to stand in the way. And so I think that there are opportunities for giving the, you know, empowering the faculty to do more with it. But I think that there's a lot of reasons, a lot of arguments for making sure that at least we know what's going on in the university.
We have a comment back here.
Thank you. First of all, it's an opposite matter. I'm going to strongly disagree on that.
Oh, yeah.
They're pretty good. But, across the fence, we don't do badly either. let me first of all reiterate what Tom said. I think it's not been fully documented the extent to which other countries are wholesalely adopting the U.S. institutional ownership model. If you want a sweeping statement, you can say that in the last 2 years, a third of the planet has come under this model, with both India this year and China last year adopting that model. The European countries have been dropping about one a year since about 1996, and the only instance of somebody going the opposite direction is Italy. I rest my case. going back to Mark's point, somebody who sits on a conflict of interest committee, I think the idea of inventors controlling their own inventions and then choosing what their lab works on is so fraught with conflict. I shudder at it. And then on the fiscal side, I think that would raise the most horrendous private enumerant issues that at some point would get some IRS attention.
By the way, before you make a comment, could you remember to introduce yourself and say who you are? And I think we have a comment here.
Yeah, I'm David Corn. I'm on the panel. I also have a disclosure. Tom's a longtime colleague of mine at Stanford, and I always have the greatest respect for his company.
Thank you. Current dean does not.
Well, that's not that. It's not my department anymore. I wanted to get back to the conflict of interest issue, because certainly for the medical profession, conflicts are a red hot issue right now. A lot of universities are struggling with how to manage those while not impeding unnecessarily the flow of knowledge into development, to put it that way. I think part of the problem, and I may be wrong, and you're welcome to just tell me I'm wrong, that's fine, but part of the problem, I think, is that historically, a lot of the transfer of knowledge into commercial development was stuff that the faculty inventor did not necessarily wish to pursue further in her or his laboratory. I mean, I had dozens of engineering friends at Stanford who made five times their salary or more consulting, and their idea was that the product moving out was beyond the academic interest and they didn't want to do it anymore. Anyway, in early stage bio research, or I guess IT, but let's focus on bio, it's not always the case that the faculty member intends to walk away from that research, even though it moves into the chain of commercial development. And those are really difficult problems for universities to manage. And how do you guys feel about that?
Extremely difficult problem, important problem. Some of the things that we've done or participated in are the maintenance of separate lab notebooks with an independent verifier of the entry in each of the two lab notebooks. Cumbersome, but at least it ensures a certain degree of effort to separate the two pursuits. The creation of a monitor not involved in the commercial enterprise sometimes the dean of a department, who is looking at every step of the way what's developed.
Who has time to do that?
There's very little time in any of this, but what we found at the University of Chicago was unless we did this, then the experiment would fail. It was an absolute necessary, without which there would be no technology transfer.
How about if the next, how about if human subjects get involved? Well, not late stage, but real early phase one. Wouldn't you do that?
When you say how about, I'm
would you consider allowing the inventor to be the principal investigator on an early phase trial of this or her invention?
The inventor or investigator should not be a PI ever. He should be involved. If it's a surgical procedure, he should be very involved in doing the first cases with the intent to teach others to do it. Drugs are a different area. But as a surgeon or an engineer, you can influence things at the time of surgery in a positive way because you've done all the animal studies, you've done the bench testing, and everything associated with it. So to come up with a policy that deters those who know the most and technically are the most proficient is not in a patient's best interest.
I agree with you. The problem is the management of that perception.
Well, what do you mean by the management?
The ethicists raise concerns that the surgeon with a vested interest in this thing should not be the one getting informed consent from the patients who are going to be the early stage recipients.
I agree with that.
So you would put some barriers.
And the individual should be monitored very closely. And if you want that done, get one of his enemies.
So
but
there,
you have to understand he's an enemy.
So there's one other area around this that I think we should cover, and I think Z, how you're dealing with this at USC might be interesting. Someone commented that there are professors who want to go around the process and start their own business and negotiate their own deals. And in fact, I don't think many of you guys know this, but someone mentioned over there Broadcom actually didn't go through the TTO office. They set their company up across the street, used university students to actually build the technology, got DOD grants, never raised a dime of venture capital, and was one of the largest IPOs in Southern California. And so, Z, can you comment on how you are dealing with those sorts of issues within the USC environment as you're setting up and representing innovation there?
Well, I think that philosophically, and I was just thinking about this last night, I thought maybe there needs to be the Hippocratic Oath of technology transfer. That, because there's definitely a lot of value that commercialization and startups can add to society, but it should not be at the expense of the reputation of academia. And, I think that a lot of, many universities deal with the conflict of interest issues, and we always use the front page of the New York Times kind of test. How would this look if it were on the front page of the New York Times? And the last thing we want to do is for our faculty to lose credibility in their research. And so I think that I think that we need to make sure that at least our house is in order in terms of conflict of interest policies, et cetera. So we've rewritten our conflict of interest policy in research recently in the last year. And that's being put into place. Our audit and compliance group has been going out and discussing it and explaining it. There's complaints from some faculty because they say, geez, you're sending mixed messages. You're saying pro-startups, the USC Stevens Institute for Innovation. And then you say, oh, but then, you have to be really careful with these sort of things. And I think that it's a matter of misunderstanding that a lot of these things can be managed. It's really a matter of transparency, and it's a matter of it's a matter of understanding what's going on so these things can be managed. It becomes a lot more difficult when there are human subjects involved. But there's things, there are ways to manage some of these things. So that's one of the first things. And the other thing is just becoming a resource. We're still staffing up. We have a couple more spots left, and we're sort of, we've been cautious about being too proactive with that outreach to faculty, but ultimately we need to be adding value. And by adding value, then the faculty are going to want to come to us. It's the carrot and the stick model, I think. Ultimately, I think I'd love to have a fund. In fact, well, we will have a fund, but it's a matter of time where now part of the licensing revenue from more recent faculty are going to start going into this innovation fund that we can use, just like the Deshpande Center grants. And what was great about the Deshpande Center was that we would have we gave out about $1.2 million in grants every year. And I know Caltech gives out GrubStake. They have a GrubStakes program, small amounts of grants. Now there's a lot of other universities that are doing this too, and you get the most excited faculty in the door with their ideas, and you get a good sense of what's going on campus. And at the same time, you can also attract the most valuable members from the community to participate, because now they see that these are things that are vetted. These are ideas that are vetted from a panel of experts. So I think that those are some of the things that we're doing specifically to address that. One more thing I want to mention, too, and it's a bit sort of contrarian, but we also feel like innovation is not just about, and this is from my own experience too. My first startup was out of MIT, but it was based on an idea that we developed in a class. It was not owned by the university, so this was just a startup that the tech transfer office didn't even know about it, which was fine. Innovation comes from all corners of the university, and a lot of the culture change comes from the students. The students are really excited about entrepreneurship. We do all sorts of different programs that I don't have to go into a lot of details, but it's really about the grassroots, empowering the students, giving them small grants to do their programs, having an innovator showcase every year. We're putting up an innovatorships program where students can get internships with local startups, and it's that kind of a, and I saw that change too through at MIT. There was a huge change when the student-run business plan competition really started gaining steam. And it was a student-run program. Students have a lot of energy. There's a lot of power that you can harness there. And over time, that changes the culture within the faculty as well.
Tom, you want to make a comment?
Yeah, we were talking about things going out the back door. If you have a dean or if you have a OTL that makes it so difficult, that's exactly what happens. And it's the dumbest thing to do. There's going to be all kinds of patent issues that are brought up that if they went through an OTL, they would be told, be careful. And driving faculty underground is the worst thing you can do. That really causes more problems than anything that I've observed in academia over my life in academia. Do not do that. You got to collaborate. And if the institution won't collaborate, you get the hell out. It's that simple. And you will avoid all these problems. And I see that going on not only at Stanford but other institutions. The other thing that was brought up I wanted to address, it's very interesting to observe how things go with different institutions. UC San Francisco Medical School used to be looked at as deterring innovation. They are now embracing it. About the time they were embracing, Stanford was changing and starting to view industry as an evil empire that was there to contaminate the academic mission. The fact is, nobody in this room can really do the process of innovation alone. You have to relate to a whole bunch of different partners, including CMS, including the FDA, and including your institution that you're in. So it really is an important thing to make everything transparent. The minute you don't, you're headed for a very, very bad direction.
Don?
Yeah, I just want to say that there are some academic studies. I believe Jerry Thursby is conducting a study now on technologies going out the back door, and that just really underscores the importance of reforming some of the university policies to prevent that from happening in the first place. But, you know, I think that's feasible.
Can I just add one comment on that? That's something that at Caltech we really feel can best be solved by trust. It really comes down to human relationships, which is why there's a couple things I'd comment on. First of all, what Catherine was saying about the inventor's role in a startup having two parts. First of all, as an inventor, you're just inventor share that would come in from any royalties. But really more importantly for a startup, which is that they're a founder of the company, right? So they really get two pieces of that. And at Caltech, we don't take more than the inventors would get. So they don't feel like, meaning that Caltech's equity in the whole deal is not greater than what the founders would get. So they don't feel like we're taking it away from them or steamrolling them, that they feel really empowered in the process. So they feel trust, and they want to come to us. And the second thing that comes down to, we've sort of touched on this a little bit, is the staffing of the office and who the OTT personnel are. It's kind of an interesting job, right? It's a mix of science and business and law. And you're probably never going to get somebody who's got all three degrees, right, to work that job. So,
too expensive.
Yeah, you can afford them. So who does staff that job? And again, at Caltech, this works best for us, is that we really find that in the day-to-day job duties for that particular position is really the science background that is the most important, because the day-to-day interactions with the faculty, we build the most trust by having scientists there talking to scientists. That just works best for them. They feel trust. They want to come to us. They feel like we can understand them. And that continues to keep those doors open between the faculty and the OTT, so that we don't drive them out the back door, but they want to come to us. Even if they're not happy with us, it's still, at least it's communication. Even if they're coming to us because they're upset about something, or that we didn't get their patent, or you know, the VC told me I couldn't be the CEO, or, you know, whatever they're upset about, they still come to us. That's still a positive relationship, right? That's still communication, and those lines of communication are open.
And I think, again, from what we've seen in the academic work, I think those of us who started studying this initially came to realize that the rate of non-disclosure was very high, and that has diminished over time. Again, this is not just in the U.S., but other countries as well.
Before I open it up to comments, Don, I want you to comment on the type of metrics or measures that you think we could use to measure success and what sort of incentive structures should be set up. But one other thing I want you to make sure you comment on is, Z kind of alluded to this. You know, there's a big question. You know, a lot of universities have decided this is their mission. And, you know, but they don't know why it's their mission. They don't know what their strategy should be. And some are saying, oh, we're going to set up these internal venture funds to help fund professors. And you can kind of say, you know, that this is going to be a way of getting the inventors to work through the process and not try to go out the back door and negotiate directly with VCs. Can you comment on whether you think setting up internal VC operations is appropriate or not?
Well, yeah, and then getting back to the metrics, I think, of course, the metrics depend on the strategic choice of the university. As I mentioned earlier, the universities have to decide whether they want to focus on sponsored research, on licensing, on startup activity, or on broader, what I would consider to be kind of broader aspects of their mission to promote economic development in the region, which would mean that they might be focusing on property-based institutions like incubators and science parks. So the choice of those metrics that they would use internally to evaluate, quote-unquote, the effectiveness of technology commercialization would depend to a large extent on what their strategic choices were. Now, I think what we've seen empirically is that the universities have slowly come to the realization that they need to focus more on the latter measures, the startup creation and the economic development measures, which are obviously going to mean that they would be ultimately measuring the outcomes in terms of the number of sustainable firms. And I think what we've seen, I know, for example, in England, there was a big push to for universities to create more startup firms, and they started evaluating the universities on the basis of the number of startups that they created, and this was not a good idea because it led to the creation of a lot of non-sustainable startup companies. So you have to be careful how you set up these metrics. But if you're looking at the broader measures, then you have to look at job creation, new firm creation, and other kinds of broader measures of the externalities that are generated through this type of commercialization.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think each university is different, and clearly land-grant institutions have a different core founding mission than other universities as well. And from the standpoint of USC, and going back to what I said about the Hippocratic Oath, the technology transfer, for us, it's really more a matter of we want to build one of the most amazing, most innovative research institutions out there. And so we see technology transfer as a part of attracting the best faculty, attracting the best students, saying this is the place to come if you want to make impact with your ideas. And so it's less. And so if we create startups, if we create technologies that are the base of new industries, it doesn't matter if they end up, I mean, we'd rather they stay in LA just because it helps feed the ecosystem, but ultimately it's really about people feeling like they can make an impact and serving that mission of making the societal impact. So it's just, I think each university is different.
Well, I also want to add to that, and again, I'm putting on my administrative hat now, which is I really think one of the most positive developments in this realm is getting the alumni more connected back to the university through the commercialization. And these alumni commercialization funds are a great way. I know we're trying to set up a fund like that to get us more connected, to get them more connected to all the technology-based activities at the university. And so, again, this may be why we're seeing more of this at university.
So can we talk about this internal fund? I mean, really, I mean, are universities qualified to manage these internal VC operations?
That's why you have.
I know what he's going to say.
Well, what are you going to say?
Hell no. Think about it. How many limited partners would you get? I don't think you get money informed limited partners because you won. That is not the university's mission. And it never has been. And they don't know how to do it. Now, you may find one or two that can do that. And if anybody in this room knows who those people are, I'd like to hear it. Okay, here we go.
Not in the U.S. In the U.K., okay. One of the noticeable things is that British technology transfer offices have been able to attract substantial private investment into their offices to fund activities. And I think the ultimate example of this is Imperial College London, whose Office of Technology Transfer is a publicly traded corporation on the London AIM Exchange.
You know, that's a very important point. I believe that. But in the United States, our patients pay themselves for the services. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. But that really puts a different light on what we're talking about and what the patient wants. So it's different, and I appreciate the value that has been brought by your efforts. I don't think anybody in the United States would give the American College of Surgeons anything. Dip, zilch, zero.
I'm Boston University, U.S., not U.K.
He just talks funny, but he's from Boston.
he talks just like where he's from.
They own the land.
Z, do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify, too. I think that there's different models. I think that calling it an internal venture fund is not – I don't think that internal venture fund makes sense. But I really like the Deshpande Center model that we, you know, at MIT, where it's a donation, it's a gift, and it, you know, other universities – so I don't mean to call it the Deshpande Center model, but it's what we did there, and it's a gift. And these are grants that are given to faculty. It enables them to advance their ideas. It stimulates the thinking. We had a first grant round. We had Doug Hart. He came up with this technology for 3D imaging. he thought it was useful for, this was in 2002, he thought great for Homeland Security, right? But we funded him, not the idea, not the market idea, but the technology was really interesting too. And over time, and looking through, you know, probably 100 different applications, they finally ended up, after rewriting their business plan several times, into a company that was using it for dental imaging, and it ended up being acquired by 3M, and 2 years later he became a millionaire, a multimillionaire. And he never thought that he was going to be an entrepreneur, but just the opportunity to think about that. So it's just a different, it's not meant as a for-profit, and I agree with you that I would never invest as an LP in a for-profit that was limited to only investing in, you know, the output of a certain university. That doesn't make sense to me.
Don, did you want to say something? Okay. Yes.
I just want to know whether the responding fund cares whether a startup is formed. If you give grants and nothing is formed, is that okay too?
So it's when we were picking the grantees, we would have a bias towards those that were more likely to turn into a startup. Any sort of commercialization at the end was a huge win. If we could also show that it led to further grants that ended up going into some other form area of discovery, that would be a big one too. But it, once we, when we picked, we had a bias for the startups. Once we picked, we said, let's now figure out what makes the most sense for the innovator and for the invention.
Yes.
I did a blog post at University of Oregon. We launched last year the Venture Development Fund, where the state decided that we could collect gift money from individuals, give state tax credits to those individuals, and then we use those monies to do seed funding. In the Portland state, we're using it as what I would say is greater connectivity funding, because small universities, we don't have the connectivity with companies that we may want, so I'm using the money to send people to conferences, you know, to send people to exhibitor booths, that kind of thing, where they can meet the kind of company folks that they need. Now, the state of Oregon is requiring us to pay back from the licensing revenue that we generate, so we necessarily have to privilege those projects that are going to ultimately create some licensing income. We're having a heck of a time raising this, I got to say, in this economic climate, but we're hoping.
So, Don, can you comment on whether you think that could work or not? Because actually, I think there's, I mean, in our experience in working with state universities who are trying to do this, the return metric, I mean, do you think that the model of depending upon licensing revenue to generate a return from a fund like that makes sense?
It's very difficult when the state gets involved, because then you have a layer of complexity, I think, that you don't have at the private schools. So I'd be somewhat, it's going to be very difficult to pay back, you know, for payback on that. But I don't think that that's the objective of the state in setting up the fund. I mean, they're not trying to maximize the return. They're thinking about the social return,
right,
and some of the externalities that she mentioned. I mean, you're getting, these are gifts. There will be ultimately some externalities created from that. So, right? I mean, that was the rationale for it.
Right, and you're right.
New firms.
If a state university person back there.
Right.
Profit.
Yes, Lee.
I'm Lee Holler. I'm with the University of Utah, and a couple of years ago, some colleagues and I were trying to understand why out of our department, I went to the Department of Computer Science School, there were so few spinoffs. And we knew it wasn't because of the environment the university was providing. We have a very supportive transfer office. We have good support for spinoffs at the highest level. In fact, there are a large number of spinoffs from the University of Chicago. We knew it wasn't because of lack of good research. The funding per faculty member is competitive with just about any place, number of papers published. We knew it wasn't for lack of example. Our founding chairman was David Evans, who went on to found Evans and Sutherland Computer, which was a primary graphics, computer graphics company. But yet there weren't spin-offs happening. And things that that I noticed, though, is that there are things outside of technology transfer, outside of conflict of interest, that may be holding back faculty from doing this. And one of them was the tenure system. The fact that the tenure system is a 6 or 7 year up or out requirement means that it's very hard for a junior faculty member who has a good idea to then put in the effort to see it's commercialized. And one of the natures, and it's one of the points made in the question, is that there is a big difference between IT, computer science technology, and medical technology in what it takes to get it commercialized. There may be years of clinical trials needed, but you know, they're clinical trials, they take time. What's needed after you publish the paper, when well received, you pointed out something good, maybe even gotten a patent on a computer related thing, is just a lot of really boring work. This is the thing to clean up the user interface, to make sure that when your mouse is over a particular menu item, a little balloon pops up as a hint. The ability to read in, if it's necessary, data from any word processor known to man. You know, and none of this can you get funding from any NSF or DARPA or anything like that. And it doesn't generate any papers. And so the faculty member looks at it and says, this won't generate grants, this won't generate papers, the clock is running. Even if I take a leave of absence from the university, which is supposed to freeze the clock, it really doesn't, or it may not, as they consider it. And so there's this holding the tenure system sort of inhibits from them. And I think, given the current state of the economy, it's going to become even worse. Why take the risk of getting off the table? I found a similar thing, although not quite as pronounced, at the high end. The full professor who shouldn't worry about it at tenure, you know, it's really nice. And that was in the university's early retirement policy, which said that in order to qualify for it, you have to have been at least 3/4 time for the previous 5 years. So you figure that any time you take off is going to bump this this thing another 5 years. And you see that there are things within the university that don't sound like technology transfer considerations, aren't things like conflict of interest, but are other things in the way they set things up that may inhibit this type of transfer. And in fact, encourage people to be less risk averse and stay within the ways the university could go.
Norman.
I just want to add a couple of remarks. I think, you know, ultimately, as our last speaker in the audience indicates, it's facilitation of the process, however we all do it, that helps faculty members participate. And I think there's a multitude of factors that we're identifying that do that. I want to just add the experience we've had in Michigan for the last about 6 years. We've had a collective commercialization fund that state universities manage together, and we've created panels that review proposals, and the nature of the proposals are to just advance the technology along the path of commercialization, and we have our criteria, and we examine those. The panels we put together have included people from universities, venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, other people in the industry. And part of the process, in addition to making those awards and generating a lot more startup companies, is we've created a much better source of feedback in the community on the development of business plans coming out of universities, and built a better network across those communities. So we've seen an improvement, not just at our major large universities, at the University of Michigan, but in some of our smaller universities that have not had the depth of experience and the same level of staffing. So it has kind of moved the needle collectively. And we've had funding from the state, and now we're getting funding actually from foundations who are recognized. rising. The fact, you know, Michigan, you all know the Michigan economy is tanking, so the foundations are the wealth of the last entrepreneurial upsurge 100 years ago, and they're beginning to recognize that they have to invest in creating a new economy. But I think looking for programs that combine the having some additional funding to make inventions more attractive with knowledge development in the community is helpful. And I think that having the tech transfer staff, the other thing we do related to facilitating issues for faculty, and I think Caltech, you know, the notion of being in service to faculty, is it's the tech transfer officers who are really the PIs on those grants. Because they're supposed to be knowing how to commercialize. The faculty member is the partner and certainly has to participate, but it's not the notion that each faculty member, and again, as the last speaker of the audience said, the faculty need facilitation, need other resources, need people who are going to help them do that, or they're not going to be as able to sustain their efforts.
Do you think, because I think one of the big issues here is universities have now decided this is their mission in different states for economic development. And in your years of experience in doing this, what do you think needs to be put in place to make sure? I mean, are the things that they talked about enough, or does there need to be more steps in the process?
Well, once again, I don't believe there's a template that fits all. In the years we've been at it, we must have seen, I would guess, 50 of these stimulative or substitute programs, either funded by the state. In Illinois, in 20 years, we've had four separate ones. I myself have been the manager of an in-university venture fund, and I must tell you that was the mother of all conflict of interest. I got out of that as soon as I realized what I was into. So I'm not too excited about an internal venture fund or even the university striking out on its own. Ashley, who is the president of the university in Boston who put $70 million in one investment?
Silver.
John Silver, yeah.
Thank you, Steve. John Silver.
I thought you'd appreciate being reminded of that. As I said, it's not a good answer because it's a variety of these devices can work provided you have the right people, the right amount of energy, the right support in the case of state government from a highly placed, powerful people, powerful person in the state. And I'm a great believer in the university president. If you have a university president active and with you, then you have a much greater chance of success. If you have a disinterested university president, then your chances of success diminish sharply. When I started, the president of the University of Chicago was Hannah Gregg, a humanist, by the way, and she was as supportive as a human being could be. She was replaced by somebody I will not name. And as
why not? They can't hurt you.
You don't know about it. And the vitality of the program went down.
Well, Don, and then...
I just want to say that Marvin, I think, pointed out another really important externality of these programs, which is something that we really need to think about, because I think that those of us who have studied tech transfer have tended to focus on the right tail of the distribution at the universities that already have a very strong entrepreneurial culture, like Caltech and MIT and Stanford, and that's not representative of the rest of the country. And
get the last one. That used
well, that's
to be.
The impression that people have. But the point is that for the representative institutions in America, this is still a relatively new activity, and we don't have the kind of system that has, you know, that already exists at the private schools. So we need these programs to develop some of the connections to the entrepreneurial community, and that's, I think, very important.
Yeah.
I'm Fred Reinhardt at Wayne State University in Detroit, and our strategy now is job creation and economic development. We're going to save the auto industry with other diversification. It'll take a while, but I think the challenge that universities face now is the venture capital. Maybe on the coast it's better, but it's hard to get venture capital interested in our startups. So the strategies that a lot of universities are undertaking are twofold. Number one, you find internal funding to bring a technology further along, and as long as you're doing it all inside the university before you've licensed it, you don't end up with a situation of, you know, private enrollment or something like that. You're just adding value to the technology, and presumably you'll recover that value when you license it by getting more back or you get more equity when a startup is created. And then, of course, in Michigan, as Marvin points out, we've got this great program that involves state funding that has then created a fund where all the universities are cooperating to do this, and it's almost like a peer review system, so it's working very well. And by the way, we do pay back 3x to that fund if your technology is licensed, so it's a nice, it's almost like a mini DC model. But the other approach is what I hear at Caltech, where you're actually essentially investing in the company with, by paying their patent expenses, you're investing, but you get equity back. But it raises some whole other issues. What we're trying to do at Wayne State is take Wayne State money, put it into a separate venture fund, which is not run by us, by the way, so thank goodness. But we're like a limited partner, if you will, and we put in a couple million, and somebody else puts in 20 million, and it's run, and we'll follow on, you know, with investors. But it has been very hard to get the university, and a lot of universities will simply have rules against taking and investing in a specific venture fund unless you have set aside a 0.5% of your endowment for these kind of higher risk things.
Don, you're doing a great job synthesizing different elements of the literature here, so let me ask you a question to synthesize another related literature. We hear about we've heard about what your description of the key things that need to go on within universities to make this happen. We've also heard about the importance, variously called ecosystem, environment, etc. I'd like to have a kind of a synopsis of key results on what are the essential dimensions, right, of the ecosystem, and this, you know, goes into the regional development literature and so on, that allow these sorts of activities to take off. Now we've heard about a pool of local managerial talent, important. Some people would argue that you don't really need local proximate VCs or VC networks, that all you need is a good idea, though we heard from Stephen that was, you know, again, the Nevada story. So do you need proximate VC networks? And then other elements, if you could just, you know, give us a sense from the literature. And what's key here is what can be influenced, okay, by the universities themselves, perhaps by regional authorities, even perhaps by federal government. So to what extent are you stuck with this, or to what extent can you, in the long run, kind of move toward a favorable ecosystem?
Yeah, I think that some of the things that we've learned, again, I think we haven't talked about as much about the property-based institutions, like the incubators and the science parks. So there is a small literature on evaluating the effectiveness of incubators. There's a paper by Marie Thursby and Frank Rothermel, some other studies, mostly based on foreign data. But what we've learned from that literature is that incubators tend to work better when there's a complementary innovation system in the region or at the university. And what that means is that the VCs are involved in the design and operation of the incubator, that the incubators tend to be more specialized as they are becoming on particular industries, and when there's a complementary educational system, when you have courses and programs at the university. Because a lot of this is kind of supply, right? I mean, there are lots of great ideas at the university, but and a lot of individuals involved in the research enterprise who really haven't thought this way. They don't know how to interact with the VC or the entrepreneurial community. So there are some educational kind of issues that can be addressed, obviously, directly by the university. Establishment of angel networks is helpful. Working with local executives, and specifically what a lot of universities are doing now is establishing entrepreneurs in residence programs. I think one of the most effective programs, it sounds like USC is doing this, is using faculty members who have successfully launched a startup as mentors for some of the other faculty members that have that kind of inclination. So those are some very specific tactics that we've seen lead to success. Venture forums. I think this idea of the administration demonstrating that entrepreneurship is important at the university by having some kind of senior administrative position, supporting that, and centers supporting that is also very important. Now, as far as changing the incentives for the faculty to get involved, that's a much more complex issue. There are a lot of individuals, because, there are now a lot of studies of startups at universities and what are the kind of the determinants of startups and successful startups. And one thing we know is that incentives are very important, but that's not really the only thing that matters. What really also matters is the culture of the department, whether the department chair is receptive to this, whether the deans are receptive to this. So it's a very complex issue, but I think there are some very, you know, kind of pointed things that universities and regions can do to stimulate this activity if this is something that they want to promote.
Well, I just wanted to throw out just sort of the reminder that I just hear a lot about the need for stimulating faculty startups, and there's a lot of money that's thrown at this at many universities, and we've heard about the challenges. If we're not talking about the right end, the right tail, but in the average, and it's a contact sport, and it's very challenging. And I feel like a lot of universities really, if we're thinking about what's the purpose of this report that you're creating here, I hope that it's sort of a not what's best for the university or for individuals, but what's best for the country or even the world. And I think that the most impact that we can make as universities is to set up our students and our faculty for a lifetime of innovation. So I don't think that we should be focusing on the individual ideas. And in fact, I think it's a great how Caltech, and we also focus on the innovator, but it's for the long haul. So I just feel very strongly about that. But I think that a lot of us sometimes focus too much on just such a small piece of the pie. Thanks.
Decisive commentary. It's another great benefit to us to have you. Thank you very much. Just a 15-minute break before we begin the next session.